Thank you very much, Nick. Thank you for being so proactive, exhaustingly proactive, so early in the morning. Optimistic. I think you've agreed to take a few questions.
Yes, of course.
So may I exert my right to ask you the first one?
Yes.
One of the important things that CER, in its brilliant prospectus, sets out is the need to send the right people to Brussels. Mm. Would it be a good idea to send somebody who spoke foreign languages, who knew the institutions, been in the Parliament, been in the Commission? Would that be a good thing?
I have no idea who you're talking about. They sound like excellent qualifications, but I certainly speak for myself, because I'm sure so many other people would fit those qualifications. I have absolutely no intention of abandoning ship. I actually moved, if you like, from Brussels-based politics to British politics precisely because, and this is perhaps where I agree with Nigel Farage, I actually think the debate is for the kind of heart and soul of the British view about the European Union, which you can't conduct that debate, in windowless committee rooms in Brussels. You have to do it on the streets and the town halls, and around the kitchen tables of British families. And that's exactly the debate to which I am wholeheartedly committed.
Very good, Tim Garton-Ash.
Nick, I wanted to ask you about the relationship.
There's a microphone.
Just coming.
Timothy Garton-Ash, Oxford University. Nick, I wanted to ask you about the relationship between the two R words, reform and renegotiation.
Yep.
To what extent do you think talk of renegotiation actually undermines our advocacy of reform across the channel, however eloquent? In order to achieve reform, don't we have to stop talking about renegotiation?
Yes, I do. Well, that's why I don't do it. But, I mean, obviously my coalition partners have a different view. I think their view is misguided and mistaken and can't be delivered for very simple reasons. If you invest... I mean, just imagine, just imagine after the next general election, the Conservative Party get a majority, so they have the democratic mandate then to pursue their ambition of a repatriation and a wholesale renegotiation of Britain's status within the European Union, and then put that to a referendum in 2017. It would condemn the next government to years and years and years of mind-numbing travel and negotiation from one capital after the next to try and sort of cobble together a package which will never satisfy Bill Cash or Liam Fox and the other, never. Because what you can deliver from sweeping off a few crumbs off the sort of European top table is never going to satisfy those whose actual agenda is not a little tweak here or a little tweak there, is actually a fundamental either withdrawal from the European Union or something very close to it. And that's why I think it is a strategy which is condemned to failure. And I think Charles is quite right. My contacts with the Germans and others, they say, well, if that does happen, of course we'd like to keep Britain in the European. Of course we would. And if we can do a little tweak here, a little tweak there will help. A little tweak here, a little tweak there is not, as far as I can make out, what large parts of the Conservative Party want. So what I think is more fruitful, which is the subject of my discussion here, and by the way, and here's the great irony, and what has been very successfully delivered in this coalition government, with David Cameron at the helm. I mean, David Cameron played a fantastic role, for instance, in the budget negotiations. And he did that by not sort of stamping his foot and saying, if you don't give me this, I'll leave. He did it as part of the coalition sort of strategy, something he and I were completely one on, saying Britain, along with other countries, finding allies with other countries, thinks that in a time of austerity and fiscal restraint, it is just simply not on for the European Union to continue to increase. And I think that's what we need to continue to do, is to make the case for bold reform which might even have been unimaginable a few years ago, but not unilaterally sort of just say, well, we want to complete, we want to discard all the bits we don't like, but only keep the bits we like, and you lot just basically have to accede to that, otherwise we'll leave. I mean, just saying that illustrates perhaps what a peculiar, to put it mildly, what a peculiar negotiating strategy that would be, and how unlikely it would be to succeed.
Caroline Lucas.
Thank you very much. Particularly appreciated the strong case you're making that reform isn't the prerogative of Europhobes, and you made a very clear case that the opposite is true. But I wanted to ask you about a tension that can sometimes arise, I think, between two different aspirations of the EU. On the one hand, to be a community of values and to spread those values, and on the other hand, to be an aspiring economic superpower. And obviously, ideally, those two are not in contradictions, but occasionally I think they can be. And I wanted to ask your view in particular about one of the recommendations in the otherwise excellent CER report that suggests removing human rights clauses from free trade agreements. You and I both sat on the Trade Committee in the European Parliament for many years, and personally, I find the idea of removing human rights clauses from FTAs deeply concerning, because that is one element of soft power that the EU does have and has used quite effectively in the past.
Well, Caroline, I'm delighted. That's the second thing we agree on this morning, in addition to getting rid of the strategy. In fact, I said to Charles just as we were going in, I said, I agree with most of what you said, but the one thing I really don't like is that Charles's point, and you should speak for the CER, is that you're not going to agree. This is, I think, the sort of realpolitik thinking behind the CER's recommendation, but Charles should speak for the CER, is that the resistance to these human rights clauses is such that in effect, it's a sort of, I think this is the CR's view, that it's a sort of poison pill to any further free trade agreements. I don't actually share that. I share your view that you shouldn't seek to divorce your values from these major sort of commercial undertakings that you make. If anything, actually, because as you know, I worked at some, actually prior even to going to the European Parliament, I worked as a EU trade negotiator, and I spent a lot of time in both Beijing and Moscow on behalf of the European Union. Obviously part of a team, just a lowly member of it, but seeking to agree the terms of China's and Russia's accession to the World Trade Organization. I've always felt that the world as a whole missed an opportunity at that point to use real leverage to you know, also promote political and civil reform. Because I think because that was a really big prize for China to enter into the World Trade Organization, and whilst, as you know, there are provisions in these trade agreements, they're often not taken as seriously as they should. So I agree. I would not. It's one of the CR recommendations. I don't so happen to agree with
the argument you've just made about China and WTO. Would you apply it to Russia and G8?
Now. Oh, well, I certainly think right now, in view of the wholly unacceptable actions of Russia in Crimea and this destabilizing and threatening stance they've taken towards Ukraine in the wake of the events in Ukraine, is entirely incompatible with us then sort of merrily going along and pretending that the G8 meetings in Russia can proceed as if nothing's happened, which is why we have actually withdrawn British officials' participation in the preparatory meetings for the G8 meeting in Sochi.
Thank you. George Parker.
Yeah, George Parker from the Financial Times. You describe what you see as the folly of David Cameron's referendum strategy. I just wondered whether you felt, given what you said about Bill Cash never going to be satisfied, whether you felt the Conservative Party was heading for a schism or a complete... it was basically going to tear itself apart over this referendum. And if that's the case, do you not have an obligation to save the Tory party from itself by saying, in the event of a hung parliament, we won't support this plan? We won't support a referendum in 2017?
I've got my hands full leading my own party, candidly. Seeking to help out other leaders is, I think, not something I will take on lightly. And I speak with reticence here, because Margot's here, and she will speak about the internal dynamics of the Conservative Party with much greater insight than I can. My own view, but... Margaret, you must correct me if you think I'm wrong. I just think buried within the Conservative Party, there is actually quite a fundamental difference between those who want the European Union to be reformed, may not like it very much, but kind of recognise that it's in Britain's interest to be part of it, and those who actually want to leave, but don't really say so. And that has to come out in the open at some point. Some Conservative MPs have basically said they agree with UKIP and they think they should leave altogether. But that's a huge difference. I mean, you're on different planets if you basically think you're committed to its membership and its reform, and you basically think it's beyond redemption, you should leave altogether. But look, all political parties, mine own included, as you very well know, George, are broad churches, and every leader always has to do his or her best to keep everybody in the same pen. But I do think on this European issue, the differences, as far as I can make out as an outsider, are really very, very profound. Indeed, they're almost as profound as some of the factors that, of course, led to the split in the Labour movement, you know, when the Gang of Four and others left, it wasn't the only reason. But I think they're not dissimilar in substance, and they're not dissimilar in intensity to some of those divisions which have plagued other parties in the past. No, look, I am committed to a referendum when there's a question to ask. And I have been for as long as I can remember. It's been my view, it's been my party's view, it's been our manifesto committee. In fact, we went further than that. After we won the general election, I was delighted to join together with David Cameron and the Conservatives and to do something that no government had ever done before, is we legislated, put into law, a legal guarantee which cannot be tampered with by other politicians and other parties, that when there's a new proposal, new treaty, new sort of rewriting of the rules, which asks new things of the United Kingdom, there has to be a referendum. It's a copper-bottom guarantee. And by the way, look at these stirring speeches that William Hague and David Cameron gave at the time to say that's the right approach to a referendum. Put it in law that when the rules change, you have a referendum. And by the way, I would go further than that. When that referendum takes place, if there are new rules put to us, Charles has views about when that might happen. I slightly agree with Charles. I don't think it's going to happen overnight, but you know, you can't rule that out forever. Then the question should be in or out, rather than just on the treaty. For the very good reason that if you look at the kind of edifice of treaties which have built up over time, John negotiated most of them, as far as I can make out. The treaty comes on top of layer upon layer of existing treaties. And so, a bit like a sort of house that's been built over time, you adapt the roof. It'd be rather odd to have a referendum only on the tiling on the roof, but not the whole thing as a package. And which is why I think at that point, you ask the British people in a referendum. It's not up to politicians, not up to Parliament, not up to the government of the day. There must then be a referendum in or out. It is the Conservative Party that has departed from the government policy which this coalition government legislated on, giving the British people the legal guarantee of a referendum. They're perfectly entitled to do so, but any suggestion that my party's been inconsistent is flatly, totally and utterly incorrect.
Next question from the middle.
Good evening, ITV News. How confident are you that your new tactic of confronting UKIP head-on will be any more successful than the tactic of ignoring them? And to that end, how concerned are you that the Home Office may be suppressing information on immigration which could help your case that being in the EU is good for the British economy?
Well, look, time will tell. I think there are many people in this country who are uneasy about the European Union, uneasy about our place in the European Union. But you can't dispel those fears or seek to address them unless you talk about it. And you can't do what pro-European politicians did in the past, including, by the way, my party, which is sort of drift into European elections and not talk about the elephant in the room, which is Europe. And I'm not going to do that this time. And, you know, I've no doubt there'll be lots and lots of people who you could very easily interview. So I staunchly disagree with Nick Clegg. What are you saying is complete nonsense. I can't deny what I think. I can't hide what I believe, and I'm not going to, because on this, I think this is really one of those issues that really stands out, is immeasurably more important for the long-term prosperity, safety and security of the nation for many, many years. It really is of a sort of axiomatic importance, far in excess of many of the day-to-day things we talk about in politics. And that's why I kind of think you can constantly try and duck and weave, if you like, according to what the latest opinion polls say. But at the end of the day, you've got to give people a choice. On the immigration report, this is not a report that has sort of percolated its way up to, you know, my desk, or I think the Prime Minister, I've sort of read it yet. It hasn't been submitted to us yet. But when it's ready, of course it'll be published. Of course it'll be published. It's really important the debate about immigration is based on facts. Now, there are a lot of fears around immigration, and there are, by the way, a lot of legitimate demands from the British people that this government, unlike previous governments, runs an effective, tough where it needs to be tough, competent immigration system. We have every right as a nation to decide who comes in and who comes out of the country, which is one of the reasons, by the way, why I'm so frustrated that the Home Office still haven't fulfil the coalition agreement commitment that I personally insisted on, that we reinsert exit checks so we not only know who's coming in out of this country, into this country, but who's going out. So I think that is a perfectly legitimate public concern. And that anxiety is very real, and I want to seek to address it. But it does need to be based on facts, and that's where there are new credible studies, for instance, on this fraught issue about the link between immigration and what happens in the British labour market, where those studies are complete, where they are credible, where they've been stress-tested, of course they should be put out in the public domain, and they will be.
Are you concerned, though, that Theresa May hasn't been entirely open about the research her department
has... As Deputy Prime Minister of this government, I've learned you have countless studies being worked on in countless departments in countless ways, and you know, they take time to kind of... they take time to be completed. But when they're completed and when they're done, I quite agree with those who've been saying this morning that on an issue of this importance, it shouldn't just be held aside for ministers and civil servants to consider. It should be made available for the public to look at as well.
Libby, would you pass the microphone to the lady on your right? On your left. Right. Yeah, sorry, on your left. We're taking two more questions now, because time is virtually up, I'm being told. We're going a female question, then a male question. Of course, by definition, the male question has to be asked by the Guardian. So could we have the other microphone going over there? Please.
Zoe Conway, BBC. Can I just clarify, you talk about this report not percolating up to your desk, but can I just clarify, did you know whether this report was being prepared? And given how important you think this issue is there not a concern here that the longer it takes this report to come out, the government can cherry-pick what figures it uses on immigration numbers?
As I say, governments of all shapes and sizes commission endless reports. Departments work on endless reports. They ask external experts and consultants and academics to issue commission reports all the time. And it's quite right that secretaries of state and ministers who are responsible for these things should know about that. But without in any way sounding grand about it, prime ministers and deputy prime ministers don't spend all their time monitoring every report that's in gestation in preparation in each department. But now that I'm aware of this report, and entirely...
Aware of it before?
Well, of course not. I'm not aware of every report that every department's working on. I will be made aware of it when departments feel that it requires collective agreement across government. And then in the conventional way, myself and the Prime Minister and our teams will look at these things and collectively agree that. I mean, that's just the way that it works. But where I completely agree, not least given the importance and sensitivity of this issue, that when this report is complete, of course it should be published, because people rightly have a lot of questions about how immigration works, and what it does and what it doesn't do for Britain as a whole. And that's why credible research needs to be put out in the public domain.
Very good. Now, the Guardian will take us back to the high ground of reforming the European Union, I'm sure. None of this party political stuff.
On the theme of the high ground of reforming the European Union, can I ask you, Deputy Prime Minister, it appears that George Osborne and some of his other Conservative Cabinet colleagues tried to ambush you yesterday in the Cabinet discussion on the Queen's speech.
High ground.
On the Cabinet discussion on the Queen's speech, saying that the bill to have a referendum by 2017 should be in the Queen's speech as a government measure. I was wondering what you thought of their tactics. And when that bill does come back as a private member's bill, not as a government bill, will you, on the high ground of European reform, try and make it even more democratic by, for example, extending the franchise, by, for example, putting the Electoral Commission question in it, bearing in mind that if you change one word in that bill, it will fail?
Look, I have a rather sort of old-fashioned view that governments work best when cabinets discuss stuff, you know, openly with each other, but not constantly in the public domain. You need a space where people who run governments can be very frank and fearless in exchanging views with each other, and not worrying constantly that it's going to, you know, be briefed out within a couple of minutes after the meeting has been completed. And that's my view about how cabinet should be run. As it happens, no one in the discussions I've had on the Queen's speech on the Conservative side of the government ever raised this issue of trying to put the EU bill into the session. So it was never raised in the many weeks and months we've been talking about the forthcoming Queen's speech. On the referendum bill, I just repeat what I said earlier. We have a government position, which we legislated on. We passed into law in an unprecedented act the guarantee, the legal guarantee about when and the circumstances in which a referendum will take place, namely when the rules change, new things are asked of the United Kingdom, and as I said, I would go then further and say that when and if that happens, the question should be in or out. It's perfectly, you know, it's perfectly understandable, and I don't in any way begrudge that. The Conservative Party has decided to change its mind and depart from the position we'd agreed. But I'm going to stick with the position I've agreed because it's the position I've been advocating for year after year after year. I don't think in a democracy you should hold referenda on some arbitrary date to basically seek to deal with internal party tensions. You have referenda in a parliamentary democracy when there's a major, major issue of constitutional significance which you need to confront. In other words, when there's a major constitutional question which you need to answer, and you think it's so significant that the whole country should decide on that. That is the way we've always treated referenda in this country. That's the way my party has always treated referenda in this country, and that is exactly what we've legislated for in this government, and that is the view that I will always stick to.
Thank you very much, and thank you for staying a little over the allotted time. Thank you for answering questions. Frankly, I hope you will go on being a keen supporter of CER,
yes,
and will spread the news about this extremely good prospectus around your colleagues in Cabinet, and then leak their adulatory responses.